Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Eve Ensler. She is a playwright, activist. She's the founder of V-Day, and she will be speaking tonight, Thursday, the 17th of March, at 6 o'clock at the Inn and Spa at Loretto, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. It's part of their Meet the Author series, and she'll be talking about her book, I Am an Emotional Creature, The Secret Life of Girls Around the World, which is now out in paperback. And then on Friday, tomorrow, at the Lenzick Performing Arts Center in Santa Fe, we will have a chance to see her new play, Swimming Upstream. That's at 7 o'clock. Welcome, Eve, to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back, and I love this cafe.
Yeah. It's a wonderful place, and it's so nice to have you actually in the cafe rather than on the telephone.
Yes.
So let's talk about this new play. This is a play about New Orleans, about Hurricane Katrina, and about all the issues surrounding that great disaster and kind of emotional reality. What was the process by which you put together the play?
Well, after Katrina, after the flood happened, we knew there was a lot going on in New Orleans and a lot of struggles women were going through down there. So we went down initially just to see how we could serve and what we could do for people. And we met with a lot of different women's groups, and we then put on this big event. And it was a wonderful, you know, it was a thing called Katrina Warriors, and it was honoring all the women who had rescued people and helped people and done things for people during the flood. And then I just felt compelled to do more because the situation was so dire at that point. And also, it just seemed to me that as terrible as everything was that happened in New Orleans, the kind of incredible abandonment of people, the racism, the just complete failure of the American government to serve the people in a fundamental way. There was somehow, I didn't feel like the story was really catching in the consciousness of America. It was going to be one of those news stories that went away. And I felt like, how do we keep the story alive? So initially I went down and I thought, well, maybe I'll do a kind of Katrina monologues. Like, well, I'll interview women and I'll see, you know, what they went through and see if I could put something together. And then I met this extraordinary woman named Carol B. Bell at a place called the Ashe Cultural Center, which is really the heart of New Orleans. And it's an African-American cultural center. And Carol B. Bell is just the queen goddess of, and you know, had rescued so many people, had been a sanctuary for so many people. I call her the Harriet Tubman of Katrina. You know, she had just been there. And Ashe had been there. And when I went to talk to her about it, she said, well, that's a very interesting idea, but can I ask you for something else? And I said, what? And she said, well, what if you didn't write the piece, but you helped us write the piece? And you helped the women in New Orleans find their voices to tell the story. And I just said, done, let's do it. You know, it was one of those moments where it's like, okay. And so for a year, I flew to New Orleans once a month. I don't even know. It was a lot. Once a month. And I met for 5 hours each time with a group of 15 women, 16 women. And the women were amazing women. I mean, they ranged from Mardi Gras, you know, dancers to poets, to singers, to actors, to, you know, it was just such an mothers. It was just an amazing range of women. And over the course of that year and a half year, they wrote and talked and, you know, made testimony to the experience of what they had been through. And to sit in that group was one of the great honors and privileges of my life, to hear the stories, to hear the sorrows, to hear the, you know, the triumphs, to hear the rage. I learned more about race, and I learned more about government, and I learned more about community organizing than I think I've ever learned in my entire life. And I also felt privy to an emotional landscape of women in community, in the art of creating something that was tremendously profound.
Now, this is something that, unlike some of the other plays that you've done, where basically you can bring it to different communities and anybody can perform it, and like with the Vagina Monologues, you could have one person or 10 people doing it, and the wonderful play that you did, I think, last year, I Am an Emotional Creature, with these incredible Santa Fe high school teenage girls doing this play. This is one where you've got the actors doing it. It's more like a cast.
Well, I think there's a few things that are different about it. There's one, both the Vagina Monologues and Emotional Creatures were fictional pieces that I wrote. This piece is very much a documentary kind of piece that is written by the women of New Orleans. I just facilitated the process. I think in the end, it will be able to be performed by a lot of different people. I don't see why not. You know, I think you just need six women and a couple of singers, and you could do this play anywhere. But we're not there yet.
Right.
In the same way that once the commercial production starts of I'm an Emotional Creature, which it will this summer in South Africa, then nobody will get to perform that piece until the commercial reality has run out, the money-making part of it has run out. And then I will give it to the world like I did the Vagina Monologues. So with Swimming Upstream, we're now in the touring phase, and the piece is still making money, which is going back to Ashe and back to Vide. That was the agreement we made. So it's a piece for good. You know, it's being able to communicate and tell the stories and keep the story alive in the imagination, in the minds and hearts of Americans. And it's also a way of raising money for our groups.
One of the questions, and there are so many questions that are asked in this story about Katrina that are so universal and they're so real, I would imagine. I just read it. I haven't seen it yet. But to everybody seeing it or even reading it, one of the first questions is, what do you take with you?
Right.
You are asked to evacuate. You have your entire life, which is embodied in possessions and place and neighborhood. What do you take with you?
It's such a great question. And, you know, I had a wonderful time in the workshop coming up with kind of the writing exercises and the questions, because they were just things that were interesting to me. You know, what do you take with you? You know, what is it like to see your life washed away? What do you think before? Do you really think it's possible, even though you've seen hurricanes come, right? Where was the failure? Because the failure wasn't Katrina. Katrina gets all the blame. The failure was the flood. The failure was the levees breaking. The failure was the government not rising to the occasion of the people. And, you know, that was the failure. And I think sometimes, you know, hurricanes and Mother Earth gets the rap when she's not always responsible.
Right. And we can even bring climate change exactly into it as another part of this whole question. And so people who are then having to decide from one moment to the next what to take with them, and then the flood happens and either they witness it or they don't, and people can go to the play at the Lensic tomorrow night and kind of relive all of that. But then questions arise like, what is forgotten? And mm-hmm. One of the things that I think this play does so well, and I have to say Democracy Now! Did this also. Democracy Now! Was one of the few news programs that actually continued to follow the lives of the people and the politics and the land grab and all that kind of stuff that happened after Katrina.
That's right.
And this play does that too. It's like, what happens a week later, 6 months later, a year later?
Yes, and I think I've always felt this about war zones and disaster zones, that, you know, the press always stays, you know, when the bombs are falling or when you have the horrible. I was looking at Anderson Cooper last night, and terrible, terrible tragedy in Japan. But looking at how, you know, people are there when it's the gory detail part, it's the horrific part. But really the hard stuff in wars, the hard stuff in natural disasters isn't then. It's after then. It's picking up the pieces. It's how do you build a life after that? How do you put things together after that? How do you deal with trauma? How do you deal with all the people who have left, all your neighbors who have gone away? How do you deal with seeing that your government betrayed you? How do you live with all those consequences? And I think one of the reasons to tell the story is that these things must not be forgotten or they get repeated. You know, I'm even looking at the situation in Japan and thinking how I really began my life as an activist fighting nuclear power plants.
Right.
That was the thing that really drove me into the streets initially. I mean, when I was younger, I was a feminist. I'm fighting the Vietnam War. But really, when I thought about nuclear power plants, I just couldn't understand how people could be building them. It made no sense. Then to be building them on earthquake zones, and then be building them, you know, by the water when there's known tsunamis. I mean, we look at, and that's happening everywhere in the world. That's not just happening in Japan. So I think the part of it is like, how do we take the story of Japan now and say, might we reevaluate nuclear power? might we rethink whether this is a form of energy we all want to be embracing? And are the consequences of it worth what it's giving us? And is there another form of energy we might be creating in its path? And I think if you don't tell the stories and you don't hear the stories, then things never happened. And Katrina happened. And the flood happened. And it isn't over for the people of New Orleans by any means.
One of the things, I mean, there are many... It's funny how when you see a play or you read a book, there's one thing that really sticks with you. And one of the things that most stuck with me was the story of the woman who had a contractor steal the little amount of money that she had.
Hmm. Well, I think one of the worst things that happened in New Orleans after the tragedy was all the rebuilding process. And you talked about the land grab and how people moved in very fast to buy off people's property and raise the rents and raise everything. So local people who'd lived there their entire lives and their families' lives couldn't move back. But I think what was also awful was there was no real watching out for contractors and who would build it. And there was no guidelines, and there was no supporting the people. And so many people got taken, and so many people got exploited. And where were you going to turn? You know, you were in an untenable position. And I think you just see that kind. And also, then there were all the workers they brought in that weren't from New Orleans, right. You know, that were from other places who didn't get where the New Orleans folks didn't get the jobs. I mean, stuff like that. There was nobody watching.
And even things that seemed like little things. A woman... found out where her dog was, and they wouldn't give it back to her.
No, that story kills me.
I know.
And she loved her dog so much, and she found her dog, and it was only a few weeks later, and they decided that where the dog had been taken, they could keep the dog. I mean, there was just such disrespect for people's hearts and for people's souls and for their integrity. And just the way people were treated on buses, on everywhere. You know, it's a shame. It's truly an American shame.
And these are the things where... when the media do their job and when the reporters are there and stay there, and when these stories go into everybody's television sets, then movements are created. And when that doesn't happen, the people are just forgotten and have to go about trying to make it work by themselves without the public attention that really is needed and that is merited by the situation.
And I think what happens is that people aren't valued. See, when you write a play, like one of the moving experiences has been when this play was done in New Orleans, for example, this year, and thousands of people came, to hear people seeing their life, their experiences, their memories be legitimized and valued. Because then they're legitimized and valued. And I think the function of storytelling is that you see yourself mirrored somewhere so you know you exist. Right. So much in the culture is not the stories of people, particularly poor people. Our culture, for the most part, mirrors the lives of the rich. And in storytelling, we see the lives of the rich, or we see some kind of distorted idea of the poor. But very often do poor people get to tell their own stories. Very often do poor people have a voice that is transmuted through the mainstream media, where they talk about the difficulties and the triumphs. You know, the women of New Orleans were triumphant. They kept that place together. The people did, but the women particularly. They carried their families, and they, you know, kept the schools alive, and they took care of each other's children, and they, you know, they nursed, and those are the stories that never get told.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. So tell us about the cast and the production of this play. We're talking about Swimming Upstream, which is tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Lensic here in Santa Fe.
Well, all the cast, you know, the cast is all now from New Orleans. For a while, we had a couple of outside, wonderful, well-known actors traveling with us. But then we just decided, why don't we just have a New Orleans cast? Because now that we're traveling outside New Orleans, it just makes it real. So many of the people are writers who are in the cast. There are a couple of people who aren't writers who are just actors who are with the cast, but they're fantastic performers, utterly fantastic performers. And you know, and some of them are multi-talented. They're writers and performers, like Troy Boucher, who wrote most of the music, you know, also wrote pieces and is an amazing singer and performer. So, you know, and Asali Devon is just exquisite poet and exquisite spoken word artist and is also, you know, a great performer and is in the play. So it's wonderful to see also how the performers have grown over the performing of the show. For months and months.
One of the other very important themes in the play that I think runs throughout all your work is how do you deal with your own rage? So here we are, women, men, children, whoever, in New Orleans. The government has let us down. We've got nothing left. We can't get into our own apartment. Whatever, somebody's stolen money from us. They've taken our dog. Violence that happens, just senseless violence that happens to ourselves or to people we love. What do you do with it?
It's such a good question. You know, I don't know about you, but for me, it's the central question of my life. What do we do with our rage? And, you know, I at various points in my life, depending on the age, I've had different approaches. But I think particularly for the marginalized, particularly for the poor, particularly for those who aren't seen and who have been disappeared in the culture, you know, there's an enormous amount of rage. And sometimes that rage isn't even felt rage. It just turns into diseases, or it turns into overeating, or it turns into drinking, or it turns into crime, or it turns into... But the truth of the matter is people have a right to be angry. They have a huge right to be angry. And, you know, when we're living in a culture where the banks and the bankers, you know, keep getting more and more, while the middle class and the poor keep getting less and less, well, all the things that should be spread amongst us are hoarded by a few. You know, when our value for the earth has plummeted to an all-time low, and people still keep drilling, and people still keep, you know, opening more nuclear power plants on the banks of the tsunami, you know. I mean, when we look at this mentality, which to me is such a... it's such a brutal mentality, you know, and such a selfish mentality and such a greedy mentality. What do you do as a person who has nothing when you see people with so much? What do you do with as a person who has been living in New Orleans your whole life and you've been told now that you're a refugee, right? What do you do with that? Where do you go in your head? I don't know. And I think in many ways I tried to create exercises where women could vent that rage and find a form for that rage. And I think there are moments in the piece that are scary, and there are moments that people wanted me to cut because it was really scary. And I was just like, no, this is theater. You know, we get to say, I want a gun and I want to blow your head off in the theater, because it's theater. We're not actually doing it.
Right.
You know, and that's why we have theater, to manifest those feelings so we don't take a gun and blow people's heads off.
There is some, I was thinking about the kind of difficulty in dealing with difficult subjects. So you don't want to see a movie that's too hard, or you don't want to read a book that's too hard, or see a play that's too hard. And then I had this little thing that I do in my head. It's like, I just see it. I don't have to have lived through it. So for me, seeing is the easy part. The people who lived through
exactly.
it are the ones who suffered. And so just... even if it's hard for me, it was way harder for them. So just cultivate your own empathy, Mary Charlotte, and just do it.
Well, I'm always shocked when I hear people say, well, the play's too difficult for me. And I go, really? Well, what do you think it was like for the people who lived through it? And I think this kind of attitude sometimes, particularly in America, of just, well, it's just too much for me. Too much for you. What's too much for us? Other people's suffering is too much for us?
And the thing is, we can take it in mass quantities that are on a level of madness when it's fictionalized.
Right.
When it's a movie where people are getting their bodies chopped into pieces and stuff like that. But when it's a much milder thing than that and it's real, we can't handle it.
No, well, because I think part of what it... how do you live in a culture where you, as a person who lives in the culture, is actually participating in inequality, in injustice, in the destruction of the earth? You know, how do you live with that if you're awake to it? Most people keep themselves very much asleep to it, because when you wake up, you're forced to act, you're forced to do something, you're forced to feel, you're forced to change. And for me, that's what being alive is. I think some people feel that that is not what being alive is, you know, and having just gone through a year, a very difficult year of uterine, you know, where I was diagnosed and recovered from uterine cancer, I didn't want cancer. I didn't want to have to go through that experience. I didn't want operations and infections and chemo. I didn't want all that. But at the same time, that's what was in front of me. And by surrendering or kind of going into that experience, it was profoundly transformative. It opened my heart. It opened me to the suffering of sick people. It opened me to the suffering of poor people who don't have access to health care. It opened me to sufferings I had never experienced. And so I feel that much more alive and that much more compelled to struggle for other people. And I think often we think if we stay clear of things, We keep ourselves protected, but in fact what we do is we keep our deadness. We keep on deadening aspects of ourselves and closing off more doors in ourselves, which further deadens ourselves.
There is a funny, you're saying doors. I was thinking of fences. Like if you fence off areas that are off limits, then your life is basically defined by those fences.
Totally.
And when you don't, there's a kind of, even though you're dealing with much harder stuff, and I see this in you, to me, you're one of the freest people I know. There's a absolute freedom when you actually face the reality.
Well, it's funny you're saying that because I've never felt more free. And I think freedom comes from a refusal not to feel. It comes from being willing to feel everything. That's where freedom comes from. You know, I have this image now, like all of us have a clock. We're all like a clock. And let's say from 12 to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we've opened ourselves to the suffering. If we're gay, we've opened ourselves to the suffering of gay people. Or if we're women, we've opened ourselves to the suffering of women. For people of color, we've opened ourselves. But from 3 to 6, we're closed off.
We're watching TV.
We're watching TV. From 6 to 12 again. But if you then say, oh my God, you suddenly, your mother dies. And from 3 to 6, you're open to people who've been in grief. And then all of a sudden, another experience happens where you get sick. Well, then from 6 to 8, if you're lucky, you get to be free from 12 to 12, right? That's the idea, is to have a clock that's completely open, to have a mandala that's completely open. And I think what we're all afraid of is that if we open it, we'll be overwhelmed, that, you know, the huge tsunami of emotion will rush over us. But in fact, I think the exact opposite happens. I think what happens is that you are alive in the river, where there's this gorgeous river of humanity and this gorgeous river of life that you get to become a part of. And you get to move down that river like a beautiful log, where before you're kind of clogged off in some little, you know, stoned, you know,
decaying
inlet.
Algae filled.
Exactly. Pus filled inlet.
And what I think also happens, and your work and your life are testaments to this, you meet other people who are as alive as you are.
Exactly. No, come on, my work has taken me around the world, where every place I go, I know the most extraordinary, particularly women, you know, who we call vagina warriors in V-Day, you know, women who have been through incredible violence, incredible pain, and rather than committing it or ignoring it, they actually grieve it and feel it and then devote their lives to making sure it doesn't happen to other people. And those women are the fiercest, most fun, most funny, most alive, most sexy, most incredible people. And I know women like that in like every country of the world. So I just spent my life with awake women in the river, you know, who are swimming. And, you know, although it's upstream, we're swimming.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. That leads into another whole very important part of your work, which is the opening of this place called City of Joy. Tell us about it.
Well, as you may know, for the last 4 years, I've been very occupied with the struggle of women in the Congo, the terrible war that's being waged in the Congo for the last 14 years, which has killed over 6 million people, and probably, there are reported between, they say, 400,000 and 500,000 women and children raped, but I think in the end, it will be in the millions. It's the greatest war really since World War II, you know, the fact that nobody knows the 6 million people have died in the Congo, the fact that, you know, until recently it hasn't made the news, the fact that 6 million Congolese could perish and that many women could be raped without anyone batting an eye is one of the, I think, more staggering things of the century.
And when you think about the number 6 million, the number
exactly.
of Jews killed in World War II by Hitler, another 6 million non-Jews
exactly.
killed by Hitler.
Exactly. And then when you think about the fact that in Bosnia, you know, where I was during the terrible war, when 20 to 40,000 women were raped in the middle of Europe within a year and a half, that war was ended. And there were many players who intervened quickly to put a stop to it. And it was white women, and it was the middle of Europe, and they were middle-class women. And I think, you know, I can't, obviously race plays a huge part here. And minerals plays a huge part here, because the war in the Congo is a war being fought for minerals. And there are minerals like cassiterite and coltan and tin and copper, and all those go in, you know, a tin, cassiterite, and coltan go into making our cell phones and our PlayStations and our computers. And so we in the West, who benefit with all these luxury items, are deeply, you know, intermingled in that war. And militias go into those villages and they rape the women and they destroy the women and they destroy the families, and they just, and the families flee, and then they take over those mines. So we essentially, when we use our cell phones, are very connected to the raping of the women of the Congo. What we were able to do, V-Day was able to do, is, you know, 4 years ago when we went there, is to really listen to what the women wanted. And at first we began a campaign that has now lasted 3 years, which has been an amazing campaign and very successful campaign, where women across the Congo have become activists and awakened to their rights and awakened other women to their rights, and, you know, broken the silence by telling their stories in public for the first time, and marched and demonstrated and done productions of the vagina monologues everywhere in the country. But we were also able to find out that women really wanted a place that was theirs, where they could heal and recover and be empowered and really become leaders. And so 2 years ago, we started building a place called City of Joy, which is really a small village. It's absolutely extraordinary place. And
built by female construction workers.
Yes, part of our crew were female construction workers for the first time in the history of the Congo. And I have to tell you, nobody believed we would ever hire female construction, including the women. They'd never been hired. They didn't know how to do it. And they ended up being, of course, the best workers. And they are now incredible leaders. And they've formed their own collective. And we just gave them a huge grant to start so they could become builders and yarders for other people. And the City of Joy will house 90 women for 6 months. Everything paid for. They will be trained in their rights, in literacy. Google just donated a tech center. They'll learn the internet. They'll learn, computers. They will have therapy. They'll have healing. They'll create some kind of economic empowerment piece. They'll be trained in radio. And when they leave, they will be leaders. And all they have to do is contract to sharing whatever they have learned with their communities when they go back. Three women will return to each community, little centers will be set up, and then they will pass on what they've gained.
And then another 90 women will come
exactly.
in.
Exactly. So every 6 months, 90 women come. We'll be able to train 180 women a year. In 5 years, we'll be close to 1,000 women. And we'll be able, I really believe the women will have at that point. They'll be in offices, they'll be in powerful positions, and they'll be very, very strong enough to take back the Congo.
It's a really important part of this that these women who have suffered the most immense, unspeakable, unimaginable trauma from that experience gain the strength to then become the most powerful leaders.
Right. Well, the whole theme of the City of Joy is called Turning Pain to Power. And I think, you know, my experience for the last 14 years traveling the world is the most powerful women in the world are women who've been through suffering, who have transformed it. And those people are, women are you can't manipulate them. They're not there for money. They're not there for political power. They're there because they want what happened to them to stop, and they don't want other people to suffer it. And I think if we can build, you know, a love army of women who are transforming their pain to power, we will see a revolution in the Congo. And it's theirs. The City of Joy is owned by the Congolese, by the Panzi Foundation. It's run by the Congolese. It's staffed by the Congolese. It's theirs. Our job in V-Day is to find them the resources. And if people want to help us do that, they can go to vday.org and donate money, because we always need support. And it's very expensive project. But I also know that if things change in the Congo for women, they can change everywhere. And when City of Joy succeeds, we will have a template, and we can take City of Joy everywhere and open lots of City of Joys, so that in disaster zones or in war zones or in any place where women have suffered, we can turn their pain to power.
The whole question, and we were touching on it a moment ago with the question of what do you do with rage, the fundamental question for women is what do you do with violence? Because I was thinking there are all these shows on TV and movies with some invincible female superhero. And the fact is, the reality is most of us cannot overpower our attackers even if we want to. And so in some really big way, as long as there is rape, intimidation, and military violence, and even police brutality as part of our reality, we are just by definition disempowered.
Well, I think about this all the time, obviously, and I have a couple of thoughts. One is one of the things we're trying to work on City of Joy is, you know, there's going to be self-defense training because we have this amazing group of people we support in Kenya who've been training girls to fight off their rapists, and they are doing it successfully now. They're going to come to Congo and train all the women and train the staff. But also, and we're fighting, and I hope what comes out of this is we train more police officers and we train more women peacekeepers. And then there's the spiritual piece, which may sound, you know, a little hairy-fairy, but I'm going to share this anyway. I don't know if you ever saw that Tina Turner movie.
No.
Well, there's an incredible moment in the movie where after she gets, you know, she leaves Ike, who's beating her mercilessly, and she gets free, and she then begins her own career, and she's really developed the spiritual practice through Buddhism. Ike arrives, and with a gun. And she just has a moment where she looks at him with her newfound power, with her newfound wisdom and centeredness and spirituality and fierceness and love. And it is impossible for him to use that gun. And there's something very teaching and instructive about that moment. I don't know how to fully articulate it yet, but I think when women come into their full power and full wisdom, there is something in the atmosphere, there is something in the cosmological makeup that changes. And I've seen it over and over again. I think people rape and pillage and do what they do because they can. And when they know they can't, things change. When people have boundaries, things change. When people realize people aren't going to take things, things change. When women refuse to say this is acceptable, things change. And I think that's what happens when you empower women. I think that's a bigger thing than guns and weapons. It's a much more abstract and intangible thing. But I can say in my own family that my father beat me for years and years and years and years. And there was a day that came when I was 17 years old, and he threw me down and started beating me with a chair. And I looked at him and I just said, "You will never do that again." And I said it in a way where he knew he could never do that again. Now, he could have done it forever. He could have always overpowered me. But something changed in our dynamic because something changed in me. And I'm not saying that's all it's going to take. Yes, people have machetes and they have guns. And of course, they can overpower women. But we are living in a climate in the Congo and around the world, pretty much, of complete impunity, where violence is not only accepted, it's expected. I mean, you go anywhere and you hear people say, "Well, of course they rape. That's what boys do. Of course they're violent. That's what boys do." We assume it's going to happen. We have to change our expectations. We have to change our assumptions. And that comes from empowerment. That comes from realizing, no, you don't only not deserve it, but it is unacceptable. And I think when that changes in a climate, then the men change. And they begin to be... Because what I'm saying is...
And you've seen this.
Oh, my God. In the Congo now, you know, the V-Men's movement, you know, the ally movement of men standing up to stuff is bigger than any place in the world. There are hundreds of men in the Congo now with us in solidarity who are training activists, who are fighting for women's rights, who are fighting for equality. And I think I really trust when that gets to be strong enough, violence gets to be impossible.
And in a really basic way, this is the real work of the world.
Exactly. Exactly. It is... I think in all our lives, you know, how do we take our rage, our righteous rage in many cases, our entitled rage, our entitled victimization, because everybody's an entitled victim. There's no one you talk to who isn't a victim in some way for something. And everybody feels like a righteous victim. But how do we actually end the cycle of victimhood perpetrator? How do we break out of that story? How do we create a new story so that the Rwandese aren't forever destroying the Congolese and the Israelis constantly destroying the Palestinians? And I'm not saying it's just a one-way story there. Obviously, things go back and forth. But I think if you look at any culture who's been victimized, there is the ongoing justification of perpetration based on your own victimization. And I don't buy that story anymore. It's not a viable story if human species is going to survive. Like, the question is, how do we as Jewish people, which I am one, how do we as women who's been abused? You know, I can look at every part of my being. I'm a Jewish woman, a rape survivor and an incest survivor. I'm a survivor of battery. I'm a cancer survivor now. I can go down the list. I'm a total victim if I want to be a victim. But how do I take my victimization and turn it into loving power? As opposed to me showing you I can do exactly to you what was done to me and justify it because of what was done to me.
Or you can just whine about it for the rest of your life.
Exactly, which is equally uninteresting. You know, a little less damaging, but right. Equally uninteresting. And I think really the test right now, this I'm working on this new book called Congo Cancer, which is really about this past year, and this whole idea of a second wind, like what would our second wind be? And I think the second wind is breaking out of this story, breaking out of the whole paradigm of victim perpetrator, of being outrageously generous in the face of people being horrible, of being, you know, so fiercely loving in the face of people being crazily mad, you know, and just saying, okay, I'm going to do it anyway. Like, what if I just did it? What if I just broke it? What if I just didn't keep going in this revenge paradigm?
And that's what you found when you went to the Congo. I mean, some of the most incredibly brutalized people were so generous and funny and joyous and kind to you.
Totally. And I've seen it everywhere in the world. You know, I think where people have suffered the most and they have broken out of that story, they are the most generous, the most loving. I mean, look, the women in Congo, I've suffered in ways I can't even talk about most of the time because the kind of atrocities, what they've been through is so grotesque and so wholly inhumane. But those women dance every day. They dance up mountains and they have no longer reproductive parts left because they've been raped by so many men. They walk on canes and they dance. You know, and I think to myself, my God, if 80-year-old women and 5-year-old girls and middle-aged women who have had their rods and sticks and machetes and melted, you know, plastic shoved inside them can dance up mountains, what on earth am I complaining about? And how could I ever walk around like a victim? And you know what? Being a victim is just boring. It's just boring. You know, I don't want to be a victim anymore. I think there's victim, survivor, leader. That's the path, you know? And I want to encourage women to go from victims to survivors to leaders.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. Now, it's been a year since your book came out, I'm an Emotional Creature, and it's interesting and I think important to think about the really big, huge things like you've just been talking about in the Congo, and we've talked about female genital mutilation and New Orleans and things like this, and then also these stories of teenage girls who were dealing with other not very nice teenage girls in the suburbs and all the kinds of different things that come up in this book about teenagers.
Well, I think it's unbelievable what teenage girls are facing in the modern world. I mean, to live as a girl in 2011, it just seems incredible. Whether it's just looking at my granddaughter who I was with all week, who's got an iPhone, iPad, you know, or whatever, all the things that are going into her consciousness, whether it's Facebook or, you know, I don't even know all the things that they're called that she, and I just think Twittering and, I mean, how do you even focus? How do you focus? She's become a multitasker at 14, but she, just the idea of actually looking and sitting down to read a book seems very difficult because the mind is so you just take that. Then you put on top of that, you know, the commodification of girls and the selling of girls for less than a cell phone in some places. Then you put on top of that practices towards girls, whether it's female genital mutilation or whether it's girls being taught that the only, you know, way to look is to be super, 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 super skinny so that they're starving themselves or having operations now when they're 10 and 12. You know, or girls who are being told in Iran that, you know, nose jobs, you know, is the only
right,
way to look.
That's right.
I mean, it doesn't matter where you go in the world. There is some mandate in some country, in some village, in some town for girls to please somebody in some way. And I think what Emotional Creature is about is like, let's change the verb. Let's move from please to defy or create or invent or love or rearrange or, you know, rediscover. But let's not please. Let's just get rid of that word for a while. Because I think this mandate to please is utterly diminishing girls' authenticity, their value, their emotion, their heart, their brains. And I also think what we do to girls is we completely devalue emotion. we completely say that the brain is more important than the heart. And we teach girls how to bifurcate and separate out one from the other, rather than understanding that actually they belong together and one does not have more value than the other. And then, in fact, you can have the greatest ideas in the world, but without a passion and without a heart and without compassion, you will never actualize anything, anything.
And that insight which came to me at some point in my 20s, that the heart and mind are not separate, but when things are going well, they're one thing working
absolutely
together.
No, I think being an emotional creature means that you are in that part of you which is intrinsically alive, and you haven't muted it or tampered with it or shut it down or shortened it. No, I was looking at a girl the other day who was growing really tall, and she was walking, like taking short steps, making herself shorter and shorter, and she was actually disappearing herself, you know, because she didn't want to be so tall and so beautiful and so powerful. And it was such a metaphor. You know, she'd already learned that she shouldn't be that powerful and that fabulous. And I said to her, why are you disappearing yourself? Why are you walking like that? And she was like, oh my God, I didn't even realize I was doing it. But it's just that unconscious thing that we do to girls, like, don't be that intense. Don't be that alive. Don't be that smart. Don't be that beautiful. Don't be that outrageous. Don't be that devoted. Don't be that intense.
There was a great little piece in Bust magazine years and years ago about a young woman who was working as a waitress, and she had very big breasts, and she always kind of hunched over to cover herself up. And one day she said, you know, but men would always be her clients in the restaurant would always be staring at her breasts. And one day she thought, you know, I'm not going to do this anymore. And she bought this bra that made her look just gigantic and pointy and stood up straight. And the men were intimidated, and they no longer bothered her, and they no longer stared at her and gave her a hard time. It was great.
Exactly. It's like, just go for it and own it. Own it. Own who you are on every level, and then everyone around you will be comfortable with it. It's your uncomfortability with your own power and own intensity that makes other people uncomfortable. And if other people are uncomfortable, too bad. Get over it.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. Now, you have been dealing with uterine cancer for the last year, and that was, as you say, another adventure, another opening, surely at moments painful and difficult as well. Do you want to talk about that at all?
No, I just think, you know, it was a shock. You know, I was here this time last year feeling really sick and had no idea. I'm on my way to Haiti, and suddenly I, you know, went and got a checkup, and the next thing I know, you know, I had bad cancer. And it was just, you know, I wrote a book a few years ago called Insecure at Last. And, you know, I really had to eat my own medicine. You know, it was, you know, the truth of the matter is we are hopelessly insecure, all of us, every minute. And I'm fortunate, I'm happy that I knew that before this happened, because I didn't have this kind of idea that I was going to escape, you know. As my friend of mine always says, none of us are getting out of here alive. You know, I didn't have that idea. I think it was shocking what my body went through, utterly shocking, and shocking that my life had to stop, shocking that I didn't know if I was going to live, shocking. There were many shocking things about it, but it was also amazing. It was also amazing, and not amazing because I like pain or want to go through chemotherapy, which is not fun, but because I just made a decision that I was to create a frame around it, which was going to be, how do I take this experience to be an experience that's going to burn off parts of me and open up parts of me that will make me more connected, more passionate, more of service in the world. And it did just that.
I imagine, I mean, you have devoted your life, whether you use this word or not, you've devoted your life to service. I imagine that all sorts of people came to your side just out of the woodwork.
Well, I say, if I didn't survive, it would have been hugely embarrassing. With the amount of love that was coming towards me. And I can say this, I want to say this on air to all the people, to the thousands of people, literally, who sent me prayers and cards and flowers and presents, you know. And I'm going to get very emotional. You know, I'm here because of that, you know. And love works, you know. And even if I had died, it would have worked, you know, because I just to have felt that loved would have made my life perfect, you know. And it's interesting because I say this all the time, but I think, had I not, you know, City of Joy opened February 4th, you know, last month, and I needed to stay alive for City of Joy to open. And I feel very much that the women of Congo saved my life because I knew that I had to be alive to be there. And I think, you know, sometimes we get sick and then we see that we mean something to other people, and that is a huge gift, and it gives us enormous fuel and enormous energy to keep doing the work. And who knows why I got sick, and who knows what will happen next? There are no guarantees. But I'm cancer-free, you know, almost a year. I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. I feel less afraid. I mean, what's going to happen now? That hasn't happened to me except for dying, you know? And there's an incredible freedom that comes from that, you know? As a friend of mine said in London, well, you've gotten it. We're all waiting for it, you know? And I said, in a way, it's true. You know, we are living in a highly toxic, highly carcinogenic world. And so much of our practices are cancerous practices. And I think if anything what cancer did is it brought me into the knowledge, the deep body knowledge of these cancerous practices. So I feel less afraid to speak out.
What do you mean by cancerous practices?
Practices where we are not valuing life. Practices where we are creating toxicity, you know, through our greed, through our moving so fast through things to get to consume things or own things or buy things or have things that we just break everything and destroy everything in our path. You know, cancerous practices where, you know, I find the whole metaphor of cancer so interesting, that it's this rapidly, you know, pathologically dividing cell, right?
That has no clue about whether it's needed or not.
Exactly. And to me, what, you know, I think so much of what this new book is about is how do I take this illness that is based on a pathologically dividing cell and use it as the pathway out of our separateness, you know, the pathway to understanding our holy interconnectedness, which is what ironically cancer's done, is made me connected to everything. And I just don't feel a disconnection. Like, there's nothing I feel disconnected from anymore. And sometimes that's scary, because even in cases where I look at people who are perpetrating terrible things and I'm furious at them and I'm angry at them and outraged, I also can see their suffering in the midst of my being, you know, resisting them, you know? And I think that makes life much more complicated and much more ambiguous. You know, if I have any problems with people in the Tea Party or the Sarah Palins, it's lack of ambiguity. It's lack of ambiguity. It's refusal to live in an ambiguous world, you know, because ambiguity forces you, I think, to live with so much difference and so much diversity and so much mess.
We're talking to Eve Ensler. So we just have a moment or two left. Would you like to invite our listeners to join you, join V-Day, anything that they can do for you and for this work?
Well, for teenage girls, you can go to vday.org and then go on to V-Girls, and there are amazing girls right now blogging.
Oh, you've got these V-Reporter girls.
V-Reporter girls have been traveling with me around the country, and in each state they visit and they blog from my state and their sites. And they're just brilliant girls, and they're blogging. Just go on V-Girls and look at what these girls are blogging. And they're all theirs. No one's editing them. This is theirs. It's their site. And I've just been so moved to hear the discussions and the issues that girls are struggling with and just their passion around things. And this burgeoning activism that is coming from teenage girls, that if we ignite, you know, I can rest a little, you know. but also, we need people's support with our project in Haiti, which is a very big project to really, the women in Haiti have come up with a very incredible vision how to end sexual violence, and we're supporting that. I'm going to Haiti next week. And our project with Congo, which is massive, and we really need donors and we need supporters, and whatever you can give is deeply appreciated at vday.org. And just get involved in V-Day and put on a V-Day, which means a production of the Vagina Monologues or Any One of Us or Memory Monologue, Rent and a Prayer, and put it on in your neighborhood and raise money for your community and give the money away to the people who need it wherever you are.
Eve Ensler, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
I loved it.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.